You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. What would you do if you were a journalist put in prison for doing your job? On today's podcast, we're going to hear from Jason Rezaian, Washington Post writer and author of the book Prisoner, about just that scenario. Stay with us. Support for the Radio Cafe comes from Lannan Foundation, presenting Boots Riley in conversation with Robin D.G. Kelly on Wednesday, September 11th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic in Santa Fe. Boots Riley is the writer-director of the comedy fantasy sci-fi film Sorry to Bother You, and a provocative and prolific poet, rapper, songwriter, producer, and community organizer. Tickets available at the Lensic or lensic.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lannan Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Jason Rezaian. He's a global opinions writer for the Washington Post, he's a contributor to CNN, and he's author of the book Prisoner, My 544 Days in an Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, a Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. He will be speaking in Santa Fe on Thursday, September 12th at 5 o'clock at the Santa Fe Higher Education Center, 1950 Syringa Road, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome, Jason.
Mary Charlotte, thanks for having me on.
So you were the Washington Post Tehran correspondent when, on the 22nd of July, 2014, you were taken into captivity at gunpoint in your apartment building with your wife. This was the beginning of a year and a half of imprisonment that was harrowing and at times surrealistic. You write about it very vividly in your book. Before we talk about this, tell us a little bit about how you became a journalist and how you chose Iran as the place you wanted to work.
Well, that's a long story, and I'm glad we have a few minutes. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My mom was from suburban Illinois, and my dad came from Iran. He came to the U.S. to go to college in the late 1950s, and in the early 60s, he and my mom met at San Francisco State, where they were both going to school. And this was a very different time in America, but also in U.S.-Iranian relations. At that moment, the number of Iranian students that were attending universities in the U.S. was increasing dramatically every year until the mid-60s and right up until the revolution in Iran. There were more Iranians studying in the U.S. than there were students of any other country. But my dad was really part of that first wave. And he made a good life for himself in the Bay Area as a Persian rug merchant, which was one of the family businesses back in Iran. And ultimately, my big brother and I, both born in the 1970s, were really having wonderful childhoods until, in a lot of ways, they were upended by the revolution in Iran and the taking of the U.S. embassy and the hostage crisis that ensued. So this was kind of one of the backdrops of our childhood. We had a large, predominantly Iranian family around us because as the revolution got closer and then happened, the number of my dad's relatives who emigrated from Iran to the U.S. really swelled. So there was a lot of people around us, and there was a real disconnect between the Iranians that I saw on television as a little boy and the ones that I knew in my family and our extended relations. So I always had this kind of curiosity about what was the truth of this society, what was the truth of who these people were, is there real antagonism between the two nationalities? If there is, what's it based on? And that really informed a lot of my early concepts of identity. I went to school not knowing what I wanted to study as a freshman in college. I thought maybe, like my dad, I would go into business. And when I realized that wasn't going to work, I thought, like my mom, I might go into psychology and become a therapist, which is what she was. And then I realized at some point midway through college that what I really enjoyed doing was writing. And I also was starting to travel a lot. In the mid and late 90s, the U.S. dollar was historically very strong. And traveling around the world was more accessible to more younger people than it really had been ever before.
Right.
So I had the great opportunity to go see a lot of different countries. And as I visited more and more places, Iran became one that I was fixated on, one that I really wanted to go to. In 1997, Iran had a presidential election, and the first reformist candidate in the Islamic Republic era was elected. And so dual nationals like my dad were starting to travel back and forth for the first time in many years. And I was eager to do the same. And it took several years to get permission to go. And when I was 25 in 2001, I finally was able to visit Iran. And it was sort of a perfect confluence of my traveling curiosity and my desire to write. I thought to myself, if I can figure out a way to spend time in this country, there's a real need in terms of journalism, good journalism from this place that has been so misunderstood for so long. So ultimately, that's what led me there. I would travel back and forth for months at a time, spend a couple months there, and then go back to the U.S. and pitch my stories to various publications until 2009, when I had a bit of a body of work to point to, when I ultimately said, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And I moved to Tehran and ended up having a really long run as a foreign correspondent.
When you were arrested, you were accused of being a CIA operative, and their supposed evidence was so bizarre. Like, one thing that they accused you of was having done a Kickstarter campaign to bring avocados to Iran. They thought that was code for something, and all kinds of other weird stuff. Tell us about that whole set of, like, interrogations.
So the interrogations began immediately. As soon as I arrived in Evin prison, blindfolded and very disoriented, they started hurtling all these accusations against me and asking me questions about everything that you can imagine, including my relationships with people I'd never met before, you know, Barack Obama and John Kerry,
right,
being the ones that stick out in my mind now. And that led to several months of hours upon hours of interrogation every day, kind of really digging into every crevice of my life, or what they were able to gather about my life, which were things that they extracted from my email, or that they found through simple Google searches, and extrapolating all sorts of insane theories about all the nefarious activities that I was up to. And, you know, you realize very quickly, but it actually took some time. You realize that what they're doing is, you know, they've already decided before they ever arrested you what you're guilty of. And they've decided what the verdict in your case is, and what they're going to sentence you to. Their job in interrogations is to kind of connect those dots. And they weren't doing a very good job of it, because these were people who were, from my point of view, not very sophisticated, very one-dimensional in their ideological loyalties, and really not understanding of how the world beyond Iranian borders actually works. So, you know, from that lens, I imagine that it's possible to think that somebody's Kickstarter project to, you know, crowdfund an avocado farm might be some undercover secret plan. But I think that I did a pretty good job of debunking all of those accusations while in the interrogation room. But, you know, you're in a very tightly closed vacuum, and whatever they say is how things are. I mean, it was very 1984 in that way. Two plus two equals five. You know?
Well, and I mean, there's moments of humor that you brought out, like when you were explaining Kickstarter over and over again. One of the guys said, "I just don't believe you. Why would anyone give money to complete strangers to do a stupid project?"
Right.
But
right. And I mean, I understand that point of view, because I lived in that society for a very long period of time. And you know, when I bring this up with other people, with other Americans, you know, there is that moment of questioning, like, oh yeah, why do we do that?
Right.
And it's about being open, pluralistic societies that support creativity and the individual and unique endeavors, which do not exist in authoritarian societies.
Right, right. Well, another thing they accuse you of, I mean, you make it so clear how, you know, stupid their supposed intelligence services were, and paranoid and clueless and with little understanding of either you or the U.S. And another thing they accused you of was writing stories that would foster greater understanding between citizens of the U.S. and Iran, stories about baseball and food and culture. Most people think that's a good thing. Why did they not?
So, you know, the people that were responsible for my capture and leading these interrogations are the group within the Iranian regime that do not want to see engagement with the outside world. They'd much prefer a more insular approach to Iran's foreign relations and management of its internal activities. That being said, everything that I was doing, every story that I was writing was completely legal, was completely transparent, was, I don't want to say supported, not supported, but, you know, my work was sanctioned by the press ministry. I mean, like, I had a permit to do my job, and every year there would be, you know, reviews, not, you know, public reviews or reviews that I had access to, but, you know, they either let you continue working or they don't. And for 5 years, they let me keep working. So, but the reality is that the organization that gives those accreditations is at odds with the organization that kept me behind bars for a year and a half. So, you know, this is where the idea of a country that doesn't pay proper respect to the rule of law, you know, how situations can run amok and people can be arbitrarily detained for long periods of time in really unjust ways. And ultimately, I think that's, you know, a large part of my story and one that I wanted to really suss out for people so they could see, you know, what it feels like, what it looks like to be thrust into a middle of a situation where you, as a someone who's been raised in a society based on the rule of law, are thrust into a situation well beyond your control where those norms don't exist.
You were put in solitary confinement for the first 2 months or so. How did you survive, like, mentally and emotionally?
I would say that the first few days that you're in solitary confinement, you are so stunned and confused that, you know, it's too early to have a really clear understanding of what's being done to you and the damage that's being done. But as time goes on, you start to realize that, okay, what's going on here is that they are trying to weaken me in every way, break me into pieces, disconnect me from reality, make me malleable, deprive me of calories and sunlight and the ability to communicate with people. You feel this happening. It's difficult to put into words at the time, but it's obviously what's going on. So, you know, I realized that there was different ways I could react. I mean, I could hear people in other cells screaming, pounding the walls. I knew from experience in my own life that responding to outside stressors with anger or angst or violence doesn't work for me. It works for some people, but not for me. So I tried to take a very calm approach to it and do the mental exercises that felt like ones that kept me closest to reality in my own experience. I relived positive moments in my life. I tried to recall, you know, information of things that used to be important to me. You know, things like the statistics in, you know, Major League Baseball, who won the World Series each year. Just mental games that you play with yourself to keep yourself sharp, engaged. And I also realized that the thing that had been most important to me in my own life in difficult situations leading up to this, and this was one of the most difficult situations I had ever endured, was the ability to laugh at things, even the things that were doing
the most damage to me. So I found things to laugh at. And as time went on, that meant my captors and my guards and the circumstances of the situation. Because as scary and harrowing and sinister as it was also pretty ridiculous.
Well, and you did your best to develop relationships with your captors to the point where you and they were talking about who would play each of you in the movie where about your when the movie about your imprisonment was made.
So, you know, I remember that moment vividly. I think that my interrogator was on the one hand trying to build me into a stronger adversary than I actually was. I was pretty weak at that point. But I also think that he was really messing with me, you know? And so I turned that situation on its head the best I could and told him that, you know, I thought it was pretty obvious that Denzel Washington would play me.
Right. And he was confused. I mean, the thing about this, you know, the relationship with your captors and the picture you paint of, I mean, that's like a microcosm of Iran's relationship with the U.S., which you talk about as being simultaneous, like, hatred and obsession. And this guy, who was supposed to be, like, a pious Islamist, was also, like, whispering to you, hey, how can I find a job in the U.S.?
This is part of the conundrum of authoritarian societies. I experienced as well in visits to Cuba in the past. I imagine if you went to Moscow in the, you know, mid-1980s, it would have been similar. You know, part of the problem for these regimes, especially these days, is that the access that people have to information, right, is much greater than it's ever been in the past with the internet and radio, satellite television. So, you know, if you want to keep a society completely cut off from the grid, I imagine that's what North Korea looks like or looked like. But even in North Korea, people are starting to get access to, you know, music videos and the internet, things that are produced in South Korea and in China. So, you know, it's part of the story that I wanted to tell was that as much as we think of Iran as this closed Islamist society, it's not. Life there doesn't exist in the vacuum. And as much as my captors wanted life to mimic a vacuum for me while I was in prison, I just knew that wasn't the case. So, you know, you play off of those things and you realize that, you know, these people, if they are affected by popular culture, American popular culture, think about the many millions of people who've already decided that they don't like Islamic rule, that want a more open society. And that's the upward battle that these guys are fighting against. So in this context where, you know, you have an American plaything, essentially, I became the personification of everything that they were fighting against.
Right. And in some ways, everything that they wanted at the same time. Your wife was released 2 months after the arrest, but you continued to remain in prison, and it became clear. I mean, this is what was so interesting to me about this. It wasn't about your being a CIA agent. That was a pretext. Nor was it really about the kinds of stories you were writing, but rather you were really a hostage, a pawn in the nuclear deal negotiations. How did you come to understand that?
I think I was a couple of things. I think I was also, very importantly, a warning sign to other dual nationals and other journalists not to come, right? To scare people away. But in terms of the nuclear negotiations, it took some time for me to realize, I mean, especially since I had no access to outside information until several months into my imprisonment. But then when I was brought out of solitary confinement, I had the opportunity to watch Iranian state television, which, you know, carried reports about me fairly regularly. And it became clear that I was an issue of contention in these negotiations. That group that took me, which I said earlier was really trying to keep the country more insular and disconnected from the outside world, were fundamentally opposed to the nuclear negotiations. And I think that they looked at my capture as part of a broader campaign to undermine the nuclear negotiations before they came to a resolution. That was their goal. but their internal rivals who were leading those negotiations with the U.S. and other world powers, rather than being affected or deterred by my arrest, were unfazed. And ultimately, they co-opted that situation and made it a point of negotiations with the U.S. So, you know, I think it's an interesting dilemma when you have people that are held hostage by foreign governments. And I make a distinction between hostages of governments and terrorist organizations. Generally, hostages of governments are being held to exact or extract concessions from another country. And in that regard, it's a strange symbiotic relationship between people who care about that hostage and the hostage takers, because, you know, your value is set based on how much of a public nuisance you make for the home government, in this case, the U.S. government.
Well, and your family worked so hard on your behalf to get you out of prison. Your wife, your mother, and your brother Ali, who basically made it his job. Talk about what they did and how much of it you were aware of at the time.
I was aware of almost none of what my brother was doing in the U.S. And I think that was by design. He understood that, you know, his communications with my wife and with my mom while she was in Iran were probably being listened to, and that, you know, too much knowledge, too many people being aware of work that was being done could be counterproductive to the greater process. But, you know, I think it started with pretty heavy person-to-person lobbying campaign with officials at the State Department, members of Congress, people in the Obama administration, and also in, you know, in concert with the Washington Post. You know, we had a really great platform to get behind me. And then mixed that with my mother, who, you know, is a blue-eyed American lady from the Midwest, coming to Iran and basically saying, all right, you say my son is a spy, I say he's innocent. You have laws and regulations about how you run your judicial proceedings. You're not following those laws. And she was, you know, fearless in her speaking up and showing up. And then my wife, you know, who was released after 2.5 months of solitary confinement, over time was allowed to come and visit me and really advise me about just, you know, sticking to my guns, not giving an inch, not admitting any kind of guilt. So, you know, a lot of things had to work in our favor. And if you look at the whole scope of things, I'm probably the only foreign national that's ever been detained in Iran and put on trial that never had a verdict in the case announced. There was no sentencing. There was no nothing. Right. And part of that was because the U.S. government, in their negotiations with their Iranian counterparts, said, hey, look, you know, if we're ever going to do a trade for these people, you know, it's going to become much more difficult if you sentence the Washington Post bureau chief to time. Right. So, you know, I think we had a lot of things working in our favor. I had an ideal team of people in my employers, my family, and the legal counsel that they hired to work with on my side. But we also had the fact that there was a long and protracted negotiation between Iran and the U.S. happening, which had not happened in the previous 35 years, and frankly, hasn't been happening since, while several other Americans still languish in prison there.
That's right. You had, once you were released from solitary confinement, the Iranian state television accessible to you and your cellmate. You watched massive amounts of television. And I recommend that people read this book because it's so interesting for you. I mean, we can't go into it in too much detail right now, but how you kind of analyze and understood this propaganda apparatus that was before you. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was that one of the goals of your captors was to get you to make a false confession to the alleged crimes. You refused to do it, and eventually their strategy kind of backfired because they kept you so long that you gained strength and confidence as the momentum for your release grew to the point that, you know, they weren't going to get what they wanted. You, and one feels this, you know, your sense of strength growing.
I think it was really palatable for me. And, you know, I started to have a real contempt and disdain for these guys. And at the same time, think of them as weak, right? And I don't think that that's the, you know, when we talk about the Revolutionary Guard, which was the organ that had me, we don't think of them as weak. But fundamentally, they are a weak force. Yes, they have guns. Yes, they have free reign over that society to enforce rules that don't exist at their own whims. But at the end of the day, they're just bullies. And, you know, they are fighting a losing ideological battle, and one that I was able to really dissect in front of them to the extent that they really had nothing to say in response. And I just started to understand that every time I would say, you know, the thing that you're doing is not Islamic. And it's not like I'm some kind of religious theologian or understand, you know, Islamic law. But, you know, there's a certain amount of common sense to it. And it's like, you know, how is it possible in Islam that you don't give people the right to defend themselves? How is it possible in Islam that, you know, X, Y, and Z? And they had no answers. So you just, when somebody doesn't have answers, especially when your back is up against the wall, you know, you just keep lashing out with those questions. And I think, I hope that some of those guys that were involved in that have taken a long, hard look in the mirror in the years since my release and started to question, you know, what it is that they were doing and for what reasons.
I mean, I can't help wishing I was a fly on the wall watching their facial expressions as they read your book.
You know, in recent months, they produced, Iran State Television produced the 30-part serial, like a nightly soap opera that was based supposedly on my many crimes. And it's very interesting because it mirrors and mimics a lot of the things that they accused me of that they obviously couldn't prove. And there's this desire on their part to portray me in a way that fits their own image of how things work. But I think ultimately, if Kazem, my lead interrogator, read the book, he would recognize every one of those scenes as true.
Ultimately, you were released in what was supposed to be a prisoner swap, but the Iranian prisoners in the U.S. didn't want to leave. One of them literally said he'd rather stay in the U.S. jail and finish out his sentence than go back to Iran. And one of the themes running through the book was the rug merchant comparison. I mean, early on, you talked about how being a rug merchant gave you some of the tools for journalism. And now that trading for rugs and trading for hostages was kind of the same thing. What in the end were the bargaining chips that allowed you, along with your wife and mother, to leave Iran?
Well, you know, the way that it played out, there were several moving parts to this, right? There was the nuclear negotiation that had been settled on in July 2015, and the implementation of that deal in exchange for lifting of U.S. and international sanctions on Iran's economy. Same time, Iran was going to cease key aspects of its nuclear program. But the U.S., as time went on, made the release of myself and several other prisoners one of the conditions of that implementation, along with, in exchange for, the release of these Iranian prisoners in American jails who were imprisoned for hostage-related violations. And then ultimately, a large amount of cash, which was an ongoing dispute for 40 years, well, at that time, 35 years, between Iran and the U.S., over funds that were frozen in the U.S., down payments for weapons deal under the Shah that when the Islamic Revolution happened and the Islamic Republic came into existence, the U.S. refused to honor. So we just kept that money for all these years. Iran sued the U.S. There's a tribunal at The Hague that was set up in the early 1980s to adjudicate these disputes. Billions of dollars have been paid in both directions over the years. This $400 million was about to be, you know, the tribunal was about to issue a verdict in that case, and it looked like the U.S. would have to pay between $4 and $6 billion to Iran based on fines and interest. So the U.S. negotiated a much smaller settlement of $1.7 billion, and part of that was going to be sent to Iran in cash. The reason for that, rhetorically, was that the Iranians, as the deal became closer to implementation, started to realize that there wasn't going to be any
early windfall of cash from the lifting of sanctions. You know, they've been selling this idea to the people that as soon as sanctions are lifted, our economic woes are going to turn around. But they started to realize, no, it's going to take years for this to make a difference. So they needed something tangible to show for it. So these were all of the things that were at play on January 16th and 17th. And, you know, rather than spoiling the end, I hope folks read that part because I think it's really very climactic, but also at the same time shows how these huge geopolitical moments and swings of history can have very real and personal impacts on people's lives, and in this case, my life and the life of my family.
You were released, as you say, in January of 2016, and that whole, like, what happens when you're released and going to a military base in Germany is also very interesting. You felt a sense of optimism when you returned to the U.S. Since then, we've seen a presidential election, the undoing of Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, and what you write about is very flawed policy toward Iran. What are you seeing? What's wrong? What do you think would be a more reasonable and practical way of engaging with Iran?
I mean, I think that realistically, you have to keep channels of communications open, whether you like a country or not. Beating up on Iran, vilifying Iran, calling out Iran for all of the many misbehaviors and bad things that it does is not very difficult. And it's been a winning policy position here in Washington for decades. But the truth is that Iran is a second-tier power that does not pose any specific existential threat to the United States or our way of life. And I say that because the Soviet Union most certainly did, right? I mean, we had this many years, the understanding of mutually assured destruction because of the vast nuclear arsenals of both the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Arsenals which, you know, the Russian Federation still has. But during the entire Cold War, you know, from the moment that World War II ended all the way up until now, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow has never closed. The Russian or previously Soviet embassy in Washington has never closed, and there's always been a channel of communications to avert accidents. I mean, think about the Cuban Missile Crisis. If there wasn't conversations going on, would we be having this conversation right now? I don't know. And with Iran, we don't have that. So my prescription, my advice, and it's not just my advice about Iran, it's my advice about everybody. Keep lines of communication open. I mean, we are talking to North Korea, right? It doesn't get any nastier than that. You know, the relationship that we have with Saudi Arabia is obviously another one that I'm very focused on and worried about. That's a country that's involved in some of the most inhumane and destabilizing behaviors in the Middle East. They've got a key to the White House, as far as I can tell. They can go to the West Wing whenever they want. So my attitude on this is hold Iran to account. Don't give it a free pass on anything, but don't isolate it so much that we have absolutely no way of influencing their decision making, which is where we are right now.
One of the things that comes through in this book also, which I think is important to talk about, is your love for Iran, not the government, but the people, the food, the culture, the whole ethos of the country. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly. I mean, I think it is one of the most fascinating places in the world. It's one of the oldest societies, one of the oldest countries. And when we say that, I mean, it has a very distinct concept of itself as Iran, dating back, you know, at least 2,500 years, if not many more. A language that's very well intact. It was an empire that, you know, reached from Europe all the way to parts of China. And that's something to be taken very seriously. But that was a long time ago, right? But the vestiges of that empire are still very much felt. And, you know, Iranian culture, Iranian literature, cinema, cuisine, music, architecture are forms that have influenced all of their neighbors, continue to influence all of their neighbors because they're so rich, right? I mean, it's a very, very, very distinct and rich, defined culture. And when you go there,
You know, I've had the great opportunity to travel to dozens of countries around the world. Iran is one of those few places where when you're standing on Iranian soil and looking around, it couldn't be anywhere else. You know, this is Iran, right? You walk into any European capital these days and it could be anywhere else. And increasingly so in big city Africa and all over East Asia and Latin America as well. But Iran is Iran. There's a beauty to it that is unmistakable and one that I wish more people could touch. And, you know, I think about our relationship with Iran and the difference between the Iranian American community and the communities of some other groups like Cuban Americans, right? For decades, Cubans didn't have any kind of interaction with their homeland. But, you know, the hundreds of thousands of Iranians who live here in the United States, a large number of them, even ones who are vehemently opposed to the Islamic Republic, travel back and forth each year. There's an attraction to the place that is impossible to ignore. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very alluring. And it's, let's put it this way. I mean, if I had my druthers, I would still be living there.
Yeah.
And obviously not given everything that's happened to me, and I wouldn't feel safe there now. And the likelihood is I'll never be able to return, even if this regime were to end tomorrow. For many decades to come, there will still be people who are loyal to those ideas living there and people who believe the propaganda that was created about me living there. So I feel like a door has been closed to me, but I wouldn't undo any of the experiences of living in that country. I loved it.
Jason Rezaian is author of the book Prisoner, My 544 Days in Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, A Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. And once again, he will be speaking in Santa Fe on Thursday, the 12th of September at 5 o'clock at the Santa Fe Higher Education Center, 1950 Siringo Road, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Jason, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.